This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 25th of January, these are our main stories. A new respiratory virus that's infected hundreds of people in China has spread to Europe, with three cases confirmed in France. As we record this edition, information is coming out about a powerful earthquake in eastern Turkey. And at least 20,000 people are reported to have fled fighting in the Syrian province of Aleppo, in what aid agencies say is a dangerous new front in the civil war. Also in this podcast.
To have this kind of discrimination is very sad. But it means that problem is there, and not only the footballers, but everybody in the street can face that kind of discrimination.
One of the English Premier League's biggest football clubs tackles racism head on. Under normal circumstances, this would be a weekend of celebrations in China. The Lunar New Year is a major holiday and traditionally a time for annual family reunions. This year, though, the growing threat posed by the coronavirus is interrupting plans and in many cases forcing them to be abandoned altogether. According to the latest figures, there are currently 830 cases of the coronavirus in China and 26 people have died. And outside China, there is growing concern. The United States has confirmed a second case, and cases have also been identified in Thailand, Singapore, Nepal, Japan, Vietnam, South Korea, and Taiwan. In the last few hours, three cases of this coronavirus have been confirmed in France. They're thought to be the first confirmed cases in Europe. There is no specific vaccine, antiviral drug or other medicine yet to combat this coronavirus, but Tarek Yasarevich from the World Health Organization remains optimistic.
It doesn't mean that you cannot treat people. You look what symptoms that the person presents to you. So you look if there is dyspnea, it's a breathing problem, is it a fever? In a severe cases, it will go to pneumonia. So depending on symptoms and stages, you will then provide certain treatment.
There are fears, however, that the situation may get worse in the next few days, as I heard from our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
And one of the things we have to factor in now is that the new year has started, so people are going to start travelling again. And in total this year, there's an expected 3 billion journeys to take place throughout the Chinese Spring Festival period. So if you factor in that 1.4 billion is the population of China, that's the equivalent of every single person in China taking a journey and going back. And we do have to factor in that some people will make more than one journey. They might make a bus journey and then a train journey. But that is a huge migration that's taking place.
And aside from the disruption to the festival, what impact has there been on Chinese people just trying to live their lives as normally?
Really, really difficult. I mean, if we look just in the province of Hubei, there's a postal crackdown now. Post is being sterilised. All schools in Hubei province, their classes are suspended, and that goes from nurseries all the way up to universities. Outside of the province, there's also a situation where a number of cities, they've started to implement a first-level response to a national public health emergency. So places where a lot of people would gather, they're cancelling arrangements that they were having. Say, for example, in Beijing, there's a university that's cancelled its exams now. And in fact, a mental health hotline has been set up today within Hubei province so that people who are literally trapped within the region can call if they just want someone to talk to.
For now, understandably enough, the focus of the Chinese authorities is battling the virus itself. But already attention is beginning to turn to the longer term impact. Our economics correspondent Andrew Walker has been looking at the possible cost to the world's second biggest economy.
This is a time of year which is increasingly seen as being an important barometer of the state of Chinese consumer spending. Last year, it was very striking how consumer spending over the New Year period did slow a bit, still looked pretty robust by many standards, but it did slow somewhat, and that was seen as an indicator of just how dramatically the Chinese economy was slowing down. So, yeah, the fact that it's coming at this time when consumer spending is such an important part of economic activity really is very important. And so you will see quite a significant impact on that aspect of the Chinese economy.
And we've seen public celebrations cancelled. There are big venues sort of closed down as well. So it has gone into so many different parts of the entertainment and the tourism industry as well.
Entertainment, particularly where you're looking at going out from your home, hotels, accommodation, transport, all very important industries that would typically expect to be really rather busy at this time of year in the affected areas are taking a really very substantial hit.
And then let's look to after this New Year holiday period, because am I right in thinking that the advice then is if you have been travelling to self-impose a quarantine period of some 2 weeks. So then the knock-on impact of that when the factories, the shops and everything are reopening after the holiday period, who is almost going to be there to go back to work?
That's an important consideration. And at the very least, you would expect some people to have difficulty getting back to work simply because of the travel restrictions. I suppose one slightly comforting feature is that it is a time when industry is largely closed down anyway. People are going on holiday normally and the factories normally closed. So there is a big surge in production and shipments from factories just ahead of the Chinese New Year. That's kind of out of the way now. But yes, there will be a significant difficulty in the period after the New Year. That is normally when there's a bit of a surge in industrial activity to make up for the period when factories were closed down. And it might well take some significant time for those shortfalls to be made up.
Andrew Walker talking to Sasha Twining. Turkey has been rocked by a powerful earthquake in the east of the country, killing at least 14 people and damaging buildings. The 6.8 magnitude quake, which struck at a relatively shallow depth of 10 kilometres, was also felt in neighbouring countries including Iraq, Syria and Lebanon. Turkish state TV showed footage of people rushing onto the streets in terror and police and rescue workers searching through a collapsed building. İrem Koker from BBC Turkish told me more about the area where the earthquake struck.
That is where a number of active fault lines are. And in the past, we had seen a number of big earthquakes with magnitude over 6 in these regions. And this part specifically, it doesn't have a high density of population. And apparently the earthquake hit mostly the rural parts of the towns. And we don't hear much damage or collapsed building in the city centres.
Has there been any response from the Turkish government yet?
Yes. Turkey had experienced lots of earthquakes, big ones, devastating ones. So in time, in the last decades or so, it developed such a reflex to respond right after it happened. And immediately after the earthquake news broke out, we heard the government officials saying they're sending aid and search and rescue teams to the area, which are also located in these parts because they are earthquake areas. And the army is ready to respond in case it help is required. And also, the Turkish government has its own scale of response to earthquakes from 1 to 4, 4 being the most intense intervention. They said their scale is 3 in responding to this earthquake.
You mentioned that Turkey is a country which has experienced earthquakes in the past. Does that mean that the ordinary people in Turkey have a plan? Is there education about what to do in the event of earthquakes? Tell me a bit about what Turkey's learned from the past.
90% of the population in Turkey, which is more than 80 million people, live on active fault lines in Turkey. So it's a reality of people's lives, and especially the devastating earthquake back in 1999, which hit western parts of Turkey. It was felt in Istanbul as well, where more than 17,000 people were killed. So it's a reality in everyone's daily lives. And I know my friends, my family, they have prepared these little earthquake bags in which they put the canned food, first aid boxes, etc. So it's a reality in people's lives.
İrem Koker. Earlier this month, when Iranian missiles hit air bases in Iraq, where American and coalition forces were based, many feared it would escalate into a full-blown war. The missile strikes were in retaliation for the killing of Qasem Soleimani, Tehran's most senior military leader, in a US drone strike. At first, Washington said no Americans were injured, but now the Pentagon has said 34 troops have suffered traumatic brain injuries. I got more details from Nick Bryant in New York.
The Pentagon has changed its story again. First of all, on the night of those airstrikes, we were told there were no casualties. Then, last week, the Pentagon revealed that several US service members were being treated for concussion symptoms from the blast. Now it's announced that 34 service members have been diagnosed with traumatic brain injury. 8 of them, who had previously been transported to a military hospital in Germany, have been brought back to the United States. Some of them are being treated at the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, which is where a lot of the people injured in the Iraq War over the years have been treated. So it's just another example of how the story has continually changed from the night of these strikes.
Yes, not just from the Pentagon. President Trump himself, just a few days ago, was playing down both the numbers of injured and the seriousness.
Yeah, here's what happened. After the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the Trump administration sent a message to Tehran through diplomatic channels, various diplomatic channels, that the United States would not retaliate if no Americans were killed in Iran's response. They were expecting a response. You remember at those two air bases that were targeted by Tehran, that force protection measures were in place. A lot of U.S. service members were in bunkers. Well, after those missiles were fired at the two U.S. bases, without any fatalities, Donald Trump tweeted, "All is well." The Pentagon, as I said there were no casualties. It all was fitting, this let's call it quits script, which had ended the cycle of escalation between Washington and Tehran. And Donald Trump is playing down these injuries now. I mean, earlier this week, he talked about the injuries being headaches and a couple of other things. And that obviously suggests that he is in no mood to seize on the fact that 34 Americans had this traumatic injury. He's not seizing on that to pick a new fight with Iran.
Nick Bryant. Staying in Iraq, and thousands of people have been marching on the streets of Baghdad, demanding that all US troops be expelled from the country. Around 5,000 US soldiers are in the country as part of the International Coalition Against the Islamic State Group. One of Iraq's most powerful and influential Shia clerics, Muqtada al-Sadr, had called for 1 million people to join the march, close to the US embassy in the capital. Martin Patience is in Baghdad.
There's a sea of people in front of me. Many of them are carrying the Iraqi flag. And it's an incredible show of strength, illustrating the influence, the power of the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Many of the demonstrators are wearing white shrouds, that's a symbol of the Sadrist movement. For now, it's very peaceful. There's almost a carnival-like atmosphere. Some of the demonstrators have brought along their young children. A man's carrying a large poster, and on the poster, it says that America is the big Satan.
Americans should leave Iraq, otherwise we will keep up the resistance. They will get exhausted, but we will never be tired. This is our country, and we are revolutionaries that are created by God. As we had the revolution of 1920, so we will have another one in 2020.
In Iraq, control of the streets is a critical part of the country's politics. This demonstration was a stark warning to America that it can take nothing for granted. The US assassination of Iran's top military commander, Qasem Soleimani, changed the dynamics here, dangerously so. Iraq now finds itself centre stage, caught in the struggle between the US and Iran. And the protesters want the American military out.
All the people here took to the streets today under the orders of the Marjaye and a great leader. Now, we don't want any American base or tank or soldier in Iraq. This time, we have gone out peacefully. But the next time, we go out under the command of a great leader who they know. We will go out armed. We will have our weapons with the help of our brothers, and we will target any American presence in Iraq.
This protest was peaceful, but those loyal to Sadr have fought American forces in the past. The tensions are building in Iraq, and that almost always ends in violence. Despite the carnival-like atmosphere, this remains not only a dangerous moment for the country, but for the region as well.
Martin Patience on the streets of Baghdad. Still to come on this edition of the Global News podcast, Wanted, a new home for the world's worst cat. To Syria now, and the plight of civilians caught up in the country's bloody civil war. On Friday, attention shifted from the Syrian government forces campaign to recapture the rebel-held province of Idlib in the north of the country. That offensive has already caused tens of thousands to flee. Syrian troops and their allies have now opened up what aid workers are calling a dangerous new front in Aleppo province, which has once again resulted in civilian casualties and flight. The International Rescue Committee has sounded the alarm. Misty Buswell is a spokesperson for the group.
Just in the past week, we have seen nearly 40,000 people fleeing their homes in northwest Syria. And it's the middle of winter here. It's brutally cold. And these are on top of the nearly 750,000 people who have already fled in northwest Syria just since last April. So, you know, this is an area that is already at breaking point, hosting many, many displaced people, a lot of people sheltering in tents. Heavy rain has been going on over the last days and weeks. People's shelters are flooding. It's a real humanitarian catastrophe that we're witnessing. And this will not be, for many of them, the first time that they will be displaced. People we spoke to in Idlib several months ago who were fleeing the violence then told us on average they had had to flee their homes five times already. We are hearing from our staff that people are absolutely terrified and they are going to flee to wherever they think they can find some semblance of safety for their children and for themselves. And, you know, their options are few and far between. Idlib is where a lot of people will go because that area is going to be somewhat safer than where they're fleeing from. They can go up towards the Turkish border, some of them. But really, as long as this conflict continues, there is no safe place for Syrians in northwest Syria.
Misty Buswell of the International Rescue Committee. The BBC's Africa editor, Fergal Keane, is stepping down from the role because of post-traumatic stress disorder. He's reported from conflict zones around the world, including the Rwandan genocide, winning an Amnesty Prize for his work there. Charlotte Gallagher has this report.
My dear son, it is 6 o'clock in the morning on the island of Hong Kong. You are asleep, cradled in my left arm, and I am learning the art of one-handed typing. Your mother, more tired.
Fergal Keane is one of the most recognisable voices and faces on the BBC. This piece, which was on from our own correspondent, became a radio classic and resulted in one of the most phenomenal responses from listeners in the programme's history. He reported from South Africa during apartheid and was in Rwanda during the genocide when an estimated 800,000 people were murdered in just 100 days.
You do not just see death here, you feel it and smell it. It is as if all the good and life in the atmosphere had been sucked out and replaced with the stench of evil.
Earlier, the BBC announced that Fergal Keane was stepping back from his role as Africa editor because of post-traumatic stress disorder, acknowledging the personal toll witnessing atrocities like the Rwandan genocide had taken. Being caught up in a traumatic event that is overwhelming, frightening or life-threatening can lead to PTSD. And while we often hear about soldiers and members of the emergency services being diagnosed with PTSD, research suggests that journalists, especially those who've worked in conflict zones, are also prone to it. The psychotherapist Mark Brain is a former BBC foreign correspondent. He says reporters are vulnerable.
As a journalist, of course, there's a kind of helplessness built in because you're there to report, not to help. And human beings are programmed to help, to try and make a difference. But as journalists, we can't. We report and we're left with it.
Fergal Keane has been praised on social media for being open about his mental health. Mark Brain hopes it will also help others.
It's really important in what we might call first responder professions, like firefighters, policemen, medical helpers, aid workers and journalists who've run in the direction of a fire or a bomb blast rather than away from it, which most sensible people would do. it's really important that it's normalized, the experience of being exposed to trauma and being potentially overloaded and overwhelmed and sooner or later needing to step back.
Fergal Keane will now take on a different role at the BBC, but the corporation says he'll continue to deliver original and compelling journalism.
Charlotte Gallagher. The Base is a US-based militant neo-Nazi group that, according to the FBI, is violent extremist and seeks to accelerate the downfall of the US government, incite a race war and establish a white ethno-state. Only this month, seven alleged members were charged with various offences, including conspiracy to commit murder. The real identity of the group's leader has long been a mystery, but a BBC investigation has revealed not only who he is, US national Ronaldo Nazzaro, but also that he's leading the Base from Russia. The BBC's Andrei Sorshnikov was involved in the investigation. What first aroused their suspicions that the Base leader might be in Russia?
Several Antifa groups on Twitter expected this because he had Russian wife and he travels sometimes and he visited Russia before. So they thought maybe he is in Russia and it's worth checking. And we used his photo. In Russia, there is no GDPR laws that protect people's privacy. So after a small combination of tactics, we found out account of his wife and we were definitely sure that he is in Russia.
And have you identified where he is living?
Yes, St. Petersburg, Russia's second biggest city. And you can recognize it on pictures.
Have you had a chance to confront Mr. Nazzaro with his real identity and what he is accused of being, namely leader of the Base?
He used to teach English in St. Petersburg, and there are several advertisements for his lessons on the Russian internet. So there is a phone number, and this phone number belongs to his wife. We called her several times and even sent some SMS, but she didn't respond, so we had no chance to talk to him personally.
When did he move to St. Petersburg from New York?
Probably summer 2018, which is the same time he created the Base, one of the most violent neo-Nazi groups in the United States.
Was the Russian state, do you think, aware of the presence of Ronaldo Nazzaro in Russia and what the organization was that he led?
They didn't know him as Norman Spear, which is the pseudonym of the Base leader. They knew him as Ronaldo Nazzaro, a guy with a Putin t-shirt whose wife always posts his pictures on social media. We don't know for sure if Russian government had any idea about his activities in the United States, and I'm afraid we will never find out.
Why is that?
Because Russian government is not so transparent. As far as we know, there is no official request from United States to Russia to deliver this person from St. Petersburg to the court.
Andrei Sorshnikov there talking to Julian Marshall. This week marked the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the largest Nazi death camp where more than a million men, women and children were murdered during the Second World War. Dozens of world leaders attended a special ceremony at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the official World Holocaust Memorial. But it's not just politicians and world leaders who are marking the anniversary. Here in Britain, one of England's most prominent Premier League football clubs, Chelsea, has commissioned a giant mural and invited the team's supporters to say no to any form of religious or racial discrimination. The BBC's religion editor Martin Bashir has been given special access to the club, and here's his report.
A safety harness used on construction sites is clipped into position. Final checks completed, the hydraulic crane creeps up one of the high exterior walls at Chelsea Football Club. But they're not refurbishing the stadium. Instead, an artist is making a statement.
At this time, it's very, very crucial for us to not forget the stories of the past.
Solomon Sousa, of British Israeli descent, has been commissioned to paint a giant mural, 40 by 23 feet, in memory of those who perished in the Holocaust.
So many people fell victim to the hatred, you know, and burned in the fires of Auschwitz.
As you arrive at the ground off the Fulham Road in southwest London, the mural covers the entire wall that greets supporters. Three distinctive characters are instantly visible, and as you get closer, it becomes clear that they are footballers.
Ron Jones, who was a British POW, he was captured in Benghazi and ended up in a sub-camp in Auschwitz for four prisoners of war.
Jones survived the death camp. The others did not.
We have Arpad Wise, who was a Hungarian footballer, then turned manager and coach. He was a celebrated footballer, and he ended up also burning in the fires of Auschwitz, along with Julius Hirsch, who was one of the saddest of this, because he was actually a German Jew. He'd actually bled for Germany in World War I. He was a decorated soldier, fought for 4 years, and was a highly celebrated footballer. He was a very, very powerful striker, and all that didn't matter in the end. He ended up being sent off to the gas chambers as well.
Well, then there might be an announcement to come over the public address system inside the stadium, and whether a racist comment is perhaps being heard by the players out there. Because
although the sport condemns any form of discrimination, some paying customers continue to use football stadiums as the forum to express their racial hatred.
So there we are. There is an announcement now over the loudspeaker to warn the crowd that there must be no further racist behaviour. Kante is going to
shoot from... And so the National Holocaust Museum has compiled a short video to mark the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Between harrowing images of the death camps, male and female players describe the danger of being silent in the face of hatred. The film begins with Frank Lampard, the Chelsea manager.
Today, on Holocaust Memorial Day, we must remember.
We must stand by.
We need to stand up.
And we need to stand together.
But what of the players themselves?
Bella's just going to work into the pink.
Here at the Chelsea training ground, under frowning skies and persistent rain, the team's doing its best to smile through the training. Captain Cesar Azpilicueta says the club has created a programme to tackle racial hatred, taking players and supporters to Auschwitz and commissioning the giant mural.
We are very aware and very involved in all the campaigns and trying to help as much as we can, and that's part of the job, and I think we have to keep going in this direction, because step by step I hope to eradicate it as soon as possible.
But as the captain of Chelsea, when some of your playing colleagues are subjected to this kind of hatred, what do you feel about that?
I feel bad and I feel sad to see this happening. Obviously, they are my teammates and we share every day, and to have this kind of discrimination is very sad. But it means that the problem is there, and not only the footballers, but everybody in the street can face that kind of discrimination.
Back at Stamford Bridge, the mural is now complete. A vivid call to arms against a form of hatred that still bedevils the game and society at large.
Martin Bashir. Now, wanted, adoptive parents for the world's worst cat. That's the enticing description put forward by an animal shelter in the US. The ad describes taking the feline on as being not for the faint of heart. Stephanie Prentice has more.
When Perdita arrived at the Mitchell County Animal Rescue Organisation in North Carolina, staff there thought that she was sick. The black and white feline had been brought in on Christmas Eve after her owner passed away and neighbours struggled to look after her. After numerous claw-related incidents and some growling, they took her to a vet who informed them that she wasn't unwell, but just a jerk. In a Facebook post, the charity are now offering to waive fees to anyone wishing to adopt her. A profile on their page says her dislikes include dogs, children, the Dixie Chicks, Disney movies, Christmas, and last but not least, hugs. It says she enjoys lurking, pretending to be sick, and staring into your soul until you feel as if you may never be cheerful again. The post has drawn thousands of likes, and a follow-up says more than 50 applications to adopt her have been submitted. In a statement, the shelter said, "Obviously, we don't know all the cats in the world, so maybe she's not the worst, but for us, she's pretty close."
Oh, adorable. Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.